It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, as they are every week, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's dive in. We don't have I've shorted you 2 minutes today, and I apologize for that. But
we have a lot of stuff to talk about.
We do. We have tons of things to talk about. And the first thing is the Greg and Jan. You'd think it was a Brady Bunch reunion, but it's not.
No, it is Mayor Greg Nichols and Jan Drago, our president of the Seattle City Council, are getting together to put on a fundraiser for the Lake Union streetcar. Now, the Lake Union streetcar is supposed to be part of a big development, a package of gifts that the city is going to give the Lake Union neighborhood in order to spur growth and attract biotech companies to the Lake Union area.
And what a gift.
Yes. It is it's projected to cost $45 million. The city says a little more than half of that will come from businesses in the Lake Union, South Lake Union area, and that the rest will come from a mix of federal, state grants, and there's some $2 to $3 million that the city will have to come up with. Now, that's also assuming that the state will have any money to throw at the Lake Union streetcar and that the federal government will have any money to throw at anything after the Iraq War continues to spin all out of control. Now, the main problem with the Lake Union streetcar is that its projected ridership.
Nobody will ride it.
Yeah, is that its projected ridership is 30 to 35 people an hour. I'll say that again, 30 to 35 people an hour. Now, you can compare that to Tacoma's new streetcar, which gets thousands of riders a day, and you can scratch your head and say, what?
Now, I was doing the math on this because we mentioned this before we went on the air, and 30 to 35 people an hour, if you figure, maybe 12 hours a day maximum, because it's primarily an office area, work area. So you'd say 12 hours a day. Give it 365 days
generous.
A year.
I think it'd be more like 9 hours
yeah,
a day.
Yeah, and 365 days a year, just to be generous again, because probably on weekends, and holidays, obviously, they're not going to have much traffic. But just say they weren't being optimistic. Say that some of these companies will actually move in so that it'll increase a little bit. You're still, over the first 10 years, and this isn't counting maintenance, this is just the original construction costs, you're figuring about $30 per rider are going to be spent by Seattle taxpayers and by area businesses in order to get this thing up and going. It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and given that it's not a big constituency that's pushing for it.
Yeah.
Right now, the lobbying effort for this thing is largely being led by Paul Allen's company, Vulcan. Paul Allen owns about 60 acres in the South Lake Union area.
Yeah. Excuse me, by the way, I said that wrong. It's not per rider, it's per ride.
Per ride.
$30. Yeah.
Yeah. Given that it's all these businesses led primarily by Paul Allen that are pushing this thing, I think the city council needs to sit up and say, wait a minute. And in fact, I think they're starting to do that. The city council issued a report. They had commissioned a person to write a report for them, an independent view of whether or not biotech would be appropriate for the South Lake Union region. And what the report found is that relying on biotech is very, very, very iffy thing to do, because even in San Francisco and Boston, places where there are large biotech clusters of biotech companies, there is no single biotech company that is among the largest employer in the city. So relying on biotech companies to bring a lot of jobs to your city seems to be very, very iffy. And then, as we've said before on this show too, that biotech companies are notorious for sucking up large amounts of venture capital and not turning out much in the way of profits. A lot of them are formed and then fold within a year or two.
Yeah, and something else we've said on this program before, that there are several areas just in the greater Seattle area and Puget Sound that are banking on biotech. It's not just South Lake Union. It's also Renton. It's also up in Lake Forest Park. It's also in Tacoma. You've got all of these local governments that are engaging in this race to the bottom to try and lure biotech companies to their area. And there's only so many companies to go around.
Yeah, and they're really just going after an illusion, most of them. And I think Seattle is also in that crowd.
Yeah, I think Paul Allen, even if he were, he certainly can afford to buy it himself, and even if he were to do that, I think it'd still be questionable just on the $1.4 million. I think it's pegged to cost per year. So
yeah, well, what really is strikes me about all this is it looks a lot like Paul Allen's bid for a stadium that the city and state paid for him, and it also looks a lot like the push for the Commons. Folks might remember that push for that big, long sort of business park that was supposed to stretch from South Lake Union into downtown, that was supposed to help revitalize the neighborhood, and really was a scam for local property owners.
Well, in the case of the stadium, you have a facility that for its main intended purpose is only used about 10 times a year, so that's roughly analogous.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one source, not the citizens of Seattle, are reaping the benefits from it.
Yep.
So it sounds like this particular effort, we're not so much buying a streetcar as a steamroller.
Yeah,
so.
And in the next couple of months, the city council is going to be reviewing this plan for the redevelopment of South Lake Union. So if folks are really interested in this, you should be checking out the city council and the city council committees to see who's going to be talking about it and when.
All right. Moving along, revelations in Florida.
I'm glad we got that word right.
Might be the only time.
Yes. the voter felon purge list in Florida, which, as you recall, was rather contentious in the year 2000. So you might think that they made particular efforts to get it right this year. Well, they did make particular efforts, but not to get it right. There have been a couple of different waves of revelations this week in Florida. The first came out earlier this week, and it emerged that a number of people who had been clemency, that's the word I'm looking for. Thousands of people who had received clemency for their felony convictions had still been purged from the voter rolls, and the majority of these, of course, were Democrats. The later revelation, I believe it was just yesterday, came out. Actually, there was a report originally in the paper on Wednesday by a paper in Sarasota, but the reason why just came out yesterday, that of the what was it, 31,000 or so people that were purged in the felon rolls in Florida, something like half of them were African American, and only 61 of them out of the entire state were Hispanic. Now, in Florida,
this is in a state that has a large Hispanic population.
Yes, and the Hispanic population is largely Cuban there, so the Hispanic population is majority Republican, as opposed to the African American population, which is well over 90% Democratic. And this is why you had the situation in year 2000 where. So many of the purgees were African American, it benefited the Republicans and hurt the Democrats. Well, in this case, they did it in reverse. They didn't purge the Hispanics, and the reason was that they were going off of the national FBI list for race and using that to link. Well, the national FBI list don't list Hispanic as a racial category. So if they had the information on their state rolls that listed somebody Hispanic, they didn't match. Because one had Hispanic and the other had, you know, unknown or whatever else they had. And so automatically you had a free pass for any Hispanic felon voter.
If you were assuming they were white, right?
Yeah, assuming they were white or assuming whatever. But so Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, has said he will look into this. Hasn't said he'll fix it. Hasn't said he'll do anything to actually
why it exists, right?
Yeah, but there's a big stink over this now, and it really underscores once again what an inexact science all of these things are, and how easy it is, you know, if you have this happen in Florida, which obviously was being examined very closely because of what happened in the year 2000, how many other states are errors at least this egregious, if not more egregious, being committed in, including Washington State? You know, and Ford is not not an a lone example here. There are many. It's important because it's a large state. We're talking, you know, a state with nearly 20 million residents.
The vote will be pretty close, too.
And the vote will be pretty close. But at the same time, you've got many, many other states where the electoral process is just as inexact, and the process of deciding who votes, and of course, as we've heard on Mind Over Matters on many occasions, how those votes are counted and the machines that are used and all the rest of this, that it needs much more attention paid to it than is paid already.
All right. Well, speaking of attention, it probably won't ever become a holiday, but Kenneth Lay Day.
Bet yes. You can't indict just one.
Yes, yes. Yes, it was this Thursday, Kenneth Lay, the CEO of Enron, was indicted for fraud and securities charges. It's been 2.5 years since they started really cranking up the investigation on these guys, and nearly 3 years since the beginning of the collapse of Enron. Now, folks might ask, why did it take him so long to bring charges against this guy? Part of the reason that it took a long time is because it just takes a long time to understand what was going on there with the Enron's books, because their transactions, they were illegal, but they were extremely complicated. So getting everybody up to speed and understanding what was going on and finding the evidence and being able to put together a case that could explain to a judge and jury what was going on takes some time. Another reason it took some time, too, is because they had to get together the evidence, including testimony from some of his associates within Enron, in order to really build a strong case, a case that's strong enough to put him away. Part of the way that they did that is they got Andrew Fastow first. He was the chief financial officer, and he was in control of a lot of these off-the-balance sheet partnerships that Enron had set up to hide their losses. They had to get Andrew Fastow to plead guilty and to put together a deal where he would sit down with prosecutors and help them out with their case. And once that happened, they were able to really go forward on this. But it has taken a lot of time because, not just because it's a difficult case, but also, and a large case, because remember, Enron was the seventh largest corporation in America in 2001. So this was a big, big case, but that's not the only reason. It's also because they wanted to make sure they could get this guy and put him away.
Yeah, and we're talking not just any corporation here, but one also that was extremely active in using its political influence and
with the
Bush administration and to elect the Bush administration. You know, how many of the millions upon millions of dollars that were raised by and through Kenneth Lay and went into the Bush campaign and Republican coffers generally were illegally gotten? That's something else that really hasn't been looked at.
Well, and then folks might say, well, it's one thing that he, you know, sent money to the Republicans. That doesn't necessarily mean he has a close relationship with them. Well, remember that George Bush used to call Kenneth Lay Kenny Boy when they were up-and-comers together in Texas. So they have roots that go way back, and he's an old family friend. So if you're a little surprised that the Bush administration might lie about a few things, just take a look at some of their associates, like the guys over at Enron.
All right. Moving along, the Senate Intelligence Report card didn't
didn't have any.
didn't give a good grade this week.
We're kind of gesturing at each other to go ahead and take the ball on this one.
They were friendly gestures.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah, yeah. No, folks might remember how we said back before the war started, look, the Bush administration doesn't have any evidence of weapons of mass destruction. It was pretty clear when we read through the intelligence report when it was released that there really was nothing there. And now...
Painfully obvious, actually.
Yeah, now they want to put it off as, well, nobody read more than the summary of the report. Nobody read the actual report, and
nobody exercised any common sense.
Right, and the CIA didn't interview these people well and check up on the Iraqi defectors to make sure that they were credible, yada, 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 yada. The truth was, they were looking for anything they could find in order to make the war go forward. the Bush administration really is the folks who are responsible for this. It's not the CIA. The CIA operates under the direction of the president. Okay, they don't operate separately. They're not an impartial authority. They operate to serve the president. And in this case, they served the president the best way they could. And that's the way that this report should be viewed. That's the way that these intelligence lapses should be viewed, that they were not intelligence lapses. They were efforts to massage the data to come to the conclusion that George Bush wanted.
Yeah, this report is really fundamentally misleading, because it talks endlessly about how the intelligence was arrived at that was you know, wrong intelligence. But it doesn't talk at all about why the intelligence was arrived at that way, how it was that... whether it was systemic efforts within the CIA that led to this. The only thing that was systemic about this is that it was understood throughout the system, throughout the analytical chain, that this was the result, this was the information that that their bosses were looking for, that the political leadership was looking for. They were looking for something with which they could justify a war, and they got what they, you know, the data was massaged in such a way that they could make the best possible case. Again, as Maria said, that's how you have to understand this. But the information that would allow us to understand that was not in this report.
It was not in the scope of the investigation.
Yeah.
So the investigation into intelligence lapses was tainted from the beginning.
All right, moving along, there's a big Senate vote coming up this week.
Yeah, the gay marriage amendment, the one that says that a marriage in the United States shall be defined as the union between a man and a woman, this is coming up for a vote in the Senate this coming week. Recall from your civics class that in order for a constitutional amendment to pass, it has to be passed by 2/3 of the Senate and then by 3/4 of the states. So it's coming up for a vote this week. It needs 67 votes to pass, which means all the Republicans plus a few of the senators, Democrats. So get on the phone, give Senators Cantwell and Murray a call. They will probably be voting against this, but it cannot hurt to buttress those votes. Give them a call at the Congressional Switchboard and let them know to vote against the gay marriage amendment.
All right. Also this week, the International Court of Justice, a body the U.S., I don't believe, is a member of.
Yes, correct? It is.
It is. Mm-hmm. Wow.
It is.
All right. Well,
Not that we ever pay any attention to their rulings, but...
But they had a ruling.
They had a ruling, and the ruling was on the Israeli wall that's being constructed, which is often referred to as the apartheid wall, in order to cut off the Palestinians from any access to... Israeli territory. Of course,
their jobs, their farms, their families.
Of course, the wall takes some interesting detours in order to incorporate Jewish settlements on the West Bank, and so it has been cutting off Palestinians from Palestinian territory. And the Palestinians claim, and I think there's a lot of objective evidence to support this, that the Israelis are using it as a way to grab even more Palestinian territory.
Yeah, quite a bit of the land that is included within the Israeli side of this wall is land that was not part of the 1967 borders. That goes into the West Bank, into the Gaza Strip, and it's a de facto annexation of additional Palestinian land.
Yeah, and in addition, it also has been creating an awful lot of conflict between the two. Now, there's a lot of conflict already between the two sides, but this just exacerbates it, makes it even harder to come to some kind of a peace agreement. It's actually, some people feel it's a step towards eventually expelling Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza Strip. That's how it's being viewed. First, you cut them off, you isolate them completely, and you start seizing more and more of their land, and eventually you just throw them out completely. Now, that's been referred to in other parts of the world as ethnic cleansing. In places like the Balkans, when an ethnic group was rounded up, fenced off from the rest of the community, and eventually pushed off their land, that was referred to as ethnic cleansing. In the Middle East, it's barely even discussed as that unless you're an an Arab in another Arab nation. Now, it's worthwhile to note that on the World Court, when they made this decision, of the 15 judges who reviewed this,
only the American
judge did not support the ruling that Israel needs to take down the wall immediately. And that American judge did not even challenge the fact that the wall is illegal. He admitted that the wall is illegal. He only said that the court needed to look more at the impact on Israelis of Palestinian suicide bombers. That was his only dissent.
Yeah, I believe he also dissented by saying that the court didn't have jurisdiction, that it shouldn't have been brought
in the
first
place. No,
actually,
that was the Bush administration who said that the court didn't have jurisdiction. I don't think
it was the American judge. Well, in any event.
And, of course, again, it's the Bush administration that can put the most, lean the heaviest on the Israelis to take the wall down. And the Bush administration said, gosh, no, it shouldn't be the World Court that should make that decision. So that shows you where Bush stands on this.
Okay. Well, that takes us to This Week in Iraq.
I wanted to talk about the security situation in Iraq because the Bush administration made a big deal about doing the handover to a new Iraqi government and how that would make everything a little bit better in Iraq, particularly the security situation. So it leaves that question open. Have things gotten better? Well, just looking at it this week, the answer is obviously, well, not quite, because there have been continuing attacks against U.S. soldiers and terrible attacks against the Iraqi National Guard. Folks might remember the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps, which was the paramilitary group set up by the U.S. government. That group has now been turned into the Iraqi National Guard. That's their new name. And that might leave a lot of Iraqis scratching their head going, this really still looks a lot like an American occupation with an Iraqi face. Now we've even got our own Iraqi National Guard. Now, the Iraqi National Guard came under terrible attack on Wednesday in a neighborhood of Baghdad, the capital city. When the Iraqi National Guard tried to go on patrol, they were met with such fierce fighting that one of the Iraqi National Guardsmen said in the 17 years he had spent in Saddam Hussein's army, he had never seen anything like it.
And that includes the wars in Iran.
Yeah, that's an army that fought in a war in Iran, a bloody war, in the 1980s, and also invaded Kuwait in 1990. So here you've got an army veteran saying he'd never seen anything like that. And that was in a neighborhood of Baghdad, the capital city. Now, the next day on Thursday in Samarra, insurgents in broad daylight at 10 a.m. in the morning fired 35 mortar rounds at the Iraqi National Guard headquarters in Samarra, a building that's also used by U.S. troops, killed some 5 U.S. troops, 4 Iraqi National Guardsmen, wounded 20 U.S. troops, and an unknown, probably a very high number of Iraqi National Guardsmen, and completely and utterly destroyed the building. I mean, blew it right down to the ground. This is war, and this is not what the Bush administration is saying. They're saying these are, 5,000 insurgents who are foreign jihadis, This is not true. That is not true. This is war, and it's a very well-equipped, well-trained, and very large fighting force that the U.S. is facing. Now, interestingly enough, the Associated Press went to some U.S. military analysts in Baghdad, and they asked them, who exactly is this insurgency? And they were shocked to find out. These U.S. military officials talked to them on condition of anonymity. They did not want to give their names, probably because their bosses would get on their case. But they told them exactly the opposite of what we've been hearing from the Pentagon as late as last week, when the Pentagon said, we don't know who these guys are, we think they're about 5,000 foreign jihadis, it's totally baffling to us how we can fight these insurgents when we don't know who they are. These U.S. military officials in Baghdad said, we know exactly who these people are. We have logged thousands of miles on our vehicles driving around to various cities in Iraq interviewing the key members of the insurgency. They are Iraqis. They are primarily Sunnis. Many of them served in Saddam's military, and the guys who fight under them, some of them are former military members, but a lot of them are just native Iraqis who are fed up with the U.S. occupation. They're nationalists. And those U.S. military experts told the Associated Press, this is not an insurgency. It's a guerrilla war. It is a nationalist guerrilla movement, and it is almost it's going to be impossible to defeat it. That's what they told the Associated Press. We cannot win this war. That's what they said. We cannot win this war. And that's not something you're hearing here in the United States, and I think it's something that we really need to wake up and see.
Yeah, and if you figure it took a number of years for that lesson to sink in Vietnam, the fact that people on the ground are saying that within a year of the beginning of this insurgency shows just how widespread and powerful it's become.
Yeah, now Ayad Alawi, the U.S.-appointed prime minister of Iraq, signed in a law this week that gave him powers to declare martial law, to do everything from tap phones to hold people indefinitely, to open mail, to ban street demonstrations and meetings. Now, of course, he cannot enforce martial law because the Iraqi police and National Guard don't have the weaponry and the training, and he doesn't have enough of them to actually do that. So he's going to be relying on U.S. troops. Last Friday, the head of the Joint Chiefs, General Richard Myers, told Congress that we could have U.S. troops, as high as 145,000 U.S. troops in Iraq for the next 5 years, performing that role for the Iraqis in a war that is not winnable.
All right, and very quickly...
Yeah, I did want to talk a little bit about the conscription of U.S. soldiers. The Pentagon last week put in place a stop-loss program that has not allowed U.S. troops that have finished their tours to come home. That is a form of conscription. It really is. And he has also... And now the Pentagon is calling
These are soldiers whose tour of duties were supposed to be over by now.
Supposed to be over by now. Yeah. They're not being allowed to come home. And now the Pentagon is calling up the individual ready reserve troops. Those are people who are in retirement who still have a little bit of time on their contract that says they can be called up in case of an emergency. Now, I think the fact that they've called up those troops may also be considered conscription, at least by those folks. Also, I think we ought to look at George W. Bush. Wasn't he in the military? Doesn't he have a little bit of time on his record that he could serve? You ought to call him up and send him over there.
Time that wasn't served in the first place.
Time that wasn't served in the first place, yeah.
Well, I suspect he's going to be out of a job later.
Yeah, he's going to need
a
job
soon. He'll have time.
He's going to need a job soon, so he ought to be on that list, too.
All right. Well, with that, speaking of time, we are out of it. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. And you're in your last week of the fun drive.
Last week of the fun drive.
One more week to go. Thank you for those people who have already donated.
Yeah,
we really appreciate it.
We've gotten some very generous donations in the last week. We are about $1,000 from our goal. And if anyone wants to make up that gap for us or help us make up that gap, you can go to our website at www.eatthestate.org. There's a PayPal button. You can click on that. Or you can send a check to Eat the State, P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145, or give us a call at 206-903-9461.
Yeah, and we owe a couple of people dinner. We've pledged that if you give more than $300, $300 or more, that Marie and I will go out and give you a nice dinner. And we'll actually eat it with you. So
and we will talk with you.
And we'll talk with you. Yes,
right.
Not just with each other. So so for major donors, we really do appreciate your help.
All right. So I start salivating for that quarter pounder.